Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, August 17th, 2022. Former Vice President Mike Pence says that he would consider testifying before the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol if he's asked to do so. Mike Pence speaking today in New Hampshire at a forum that is known for featuring politicians who are considering running for president as campaign 2024 kicks off on C-SPAN. Results from campaign 2022, two Republicans who voted to impeach former President Trump facing voters in primaries this week, one losing, Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the other moving on to the general election, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. The federal government announcing cuts to Western state water allocations from the Colorado River due to the severe and prolonged drought. We will talk about that with a reporter at the Arizona Republic. And the United States weighing Iran's response to a European negotiated framework for the U.S. to re-enter the 2015 nuclear agreement. We'll hear from the State Department and get analysis from Heritage Foundation scholar Peter Brooks, all ahead on Washington Today. The story from WMUR-TV in Manchester, New Hampshire, former Vice President Mike Pence indicated on Wednesday morning that he would consider testifying before the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Pence, who drew the ire of former President Donald Trump supporters when he played a role in certifying the results of the 2020 election, which he and Trump lost, told a crowd at St. Anselm College that he would think about testifying if invited. That from WMUR. Mike Pence was at an event known as Politics and Eggs. It describes itself as a must-stop on the presidential campaign trail, as Mike Pence is considering a possible 2024 presidential run in the first in the nation presidential primary state of New Hampshire, at least for the Republican Party. Democrats going in a different direction. Here's some questions to Mike Pence from Jim Brett, president and CEO of the New England Council, who co-hosts Politics and Eggs with the New Hampshire Institute of Politics.
January 6th committee, do you think they are providing a public service to the citizens of this country? Are they providing information that none of us was aware of? And overall, what kind of a grade or evaluation would you give them?
The January 6th was a tragic day in the history of our country, not just for those of us that lived through it at the Capitol, but for every American. I mean, to see our historic Capitol ransacked, I must tell you, angered me that day. But thanks to the heroic efforts of law enforcement, Capitol Hill Police, federal law enforcement, the violence was quelled. And what began as a day of tragedy, I believe, was ultimately a triumph of freedom. Because on the very same day of the worst attack on our Capitol since 1812, the American people and the world witnessed the elected representatives of this country reconvene and seated the orderly transition of power under the Constitution of the United States. Now, I must tell you that the American people have a right to know what happened that day. And in the months and years ahead, I'll be telling my story even more frequently than I have. I just finished writing a book that begins with that grandfather he mentioned coming over from Ireland, and it ends with the day that I left office and every day in between. But I must tell you that whatever the intentions of the January 6th committee, I was disappointed when Speaker Pelosi broke tradition in the Congress where I served for 12 years and refused to seat Republican members that were appointed by the minority leader. It's simply never been done. I mean, the tradition in the Congress is the majority gets the majority of seats on committees and the minority gets a minority of seats. And each side gets to pick who sits in those seats. Right up until then. And I think it was a missed opportunity for the American people. I was on Capitol Hill on 9/11 as well. The 9/11 Commission did a great service to the country because they went above politics. They brought together men and women that were respected, on both sides of the aisle that came and were able to learn what we could learn about what led to that fateful day in 2001. And Jim, I can't help but feel whatever the intentions of this in the very beginning, that it's, and whatever new information's come out to the American people, and more will come. I think the opportunity that we had to bring the country together to learn the lessons that we should learn from that day and to internalize them going forward, and ultimately to celebrate those, beginning with law enforcement who made it possible for it to be a victory for freedom. It's been a missed opportunity.
Just to stay on that, Jeremy said, if they were to call you to the committee to come and testify and talk, would you be agreeable?
Well, I would, if there was an invitation to participate, I would consider it. But you've heard me mention the Constitution a few times this morning. On the Constitution, we have three co-equal branches of government. And any invitation to be directed to me, I would have to reflect on the unique role that I was serving in as Vice President. It would be unprecedented in history for a Vice President to be summoned to testify on Capitol Hill. But I don't want to prejudge. If there's ever any formal invitation rendered to us, we give it due consideration. But my first obligation is to continue to uphold my oath, continue to uphold the framework of government enshrined in the Constitution that has created the greatest nation in the history of the world. We'll do that. And we'll do that.
Former Vice President Mike Pence in New Hampshire at the Politics and Eggs speaking series at St. Anselm College in Manchester this morning. He also, during his speech, criticized other Republicans who have attacked the FBI over the search of former President Donald Trump's estate in Florida, saying, "I want to remind my fellow Republicans we can hold the Attorney General accountable for the decision that he made without attacking the rank-and-file enforcement personnel at the FBI." About what Vice President Mike Pence said, it would be unprecedented in history to be called to testify before Congress. USA Today writing about this, adding this, it wouldn't be the first time a president or vice president had testified before a congressional committee. At least six presidents and one vice president, Schuyler Colfax, vice president to President Ulysses S. Grant, testified before congressional committees, according to the U.S. Senate website. The vice chair of that House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol is Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming. She was beaten on Tuesday in a Republican primary in her run for re-election by attorney Harriet Hageman, who was endorsed by former President Trump. Hageman getting 66% of the primary vote to Cheney's 29%. Liz Cheney conceding Tuesday night in Jackson, Wyoming, shortly after the polls closed.
No House seat, no office in this land is more important than the principles that we are all sworn to protect. And I well understood the potential political consequences of abiding by my duty. Our republic relies upon the goodwill of all candidates for office to accept honorably the outcome of elections. And tonight, Harriet Hageman has received the most votes in this primary. She won. I called her to concede the race. This primary election is over, but now the real work begins.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Tuesday night, she was one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach former President Trump, and for that, the former president has been endorsing their re-election opponents. Donald Trump on social media calling Liz Cheney spiteful and a fool, and writing, "This is a wonderful result for America and a complete rebuke of the Unselect Committee of Political Hacks and Thugs." Liz Cheney, in her speech Tuesday, also promising to continue to oppose what she sees as the danger former President Trump poses to U.S. democracy.
We must be very clear-eyed about the threat we face and about what is required to defeat it. I have said since January 6th that I will do whatever it takes to ensure Donald Trump is never again anywhere near the Oval Office, and I mean it. This is a fight for all of us together. I'm a conservative Republican. I believe deeply in the principles and the ideals on which my party was founded. I love its history, and I love what our party has stood for. But I love my country more. So I ask you tonight to join me. As we leave here, let us resolve that we will stand together, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, against those who would destroy our republic. They are angry and they are determined, but they have not seen anything like the power of Americans united in defense of our Constitution and committed to the cause of freedom. There is no greater power on this earth, and with God's help, we will prevail. Thank you all. God bless you. God bless Wyoming. God bless the United States of America. Thank you, guys.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney Tuesday night in Jackson to her supporters after her re-election primary loss. The victor in that race, Harriet Hageman, speaking to her supporters in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Yes, Wyoming has spoken, and we have made it clear that we are taking our country back. By our vote today, Wyoming has put the elites on notice. We are no longer going to tolerate representatives who don't represent us. Wyoming has made clear that we are done being governed by the Washington, D.C. uniparty. Those Democrats and Republicans who don't really care which party is in power, just as long as they are. Wyoming has sent the message that if you are going to claim to live in Wyoming, you better damn well live in Wyoming. Wyoming has drawn a line in the sand that if we put you in power, you will be accountable to us, you will answer to us, and you will do what is in our best interest. And if you don't, we will fire you. Wyoming deserves a real representative in Congress, one that understands Wyoming, one that loves Wyoming, and one that loves Wyoming as much as all of us do. I will be accountable to the voters and citizens of Wyoming because I am one of you. And just like you, I am sick and tired of not having a voice in the U.S. House of Representatives. Today we have succeeded at what we set out to do. We have reclaimed Wyoming's lone congressional seat for Wyoming. Do this on my own. Obviously, we're all very grateful to President Trump, who recognizes that Wyoming has only one congressional representative, and we have to make it count. His clear and unwavering support from the very beginning propelled us to victory tonight.
Harriet Hageman Tuesday night in Cheyenne, Wyoming, after defeating Congresswoman Liz Cheney in a Republican election primary. Harriet Hageman moving on to the general election in November. And since Wyoming is overwhelmingly Republican, giving 70% of its vote the last presidential election to Donald Trump, Harriet Hageman is the clear favorite to win the election and become a member of Congress. C-SPAN spoke to political congressional reporter Nicholas Wu about the significance of Liz Cheney's loss, her possible future plans, and possible influence going forward on the Republican Party.
Well, I think the takeaway here is that Congresswoman Cheney is looking beyond this election in terms of her own political future, right? We learned this morning that she's launching a new political vehicle. It's not clear exactly what it will be for yet, but you know, it's striking that she hasn't ruled out a 2024 presidential bid. So that might be the next thing on everyone's radars here. She's trying to see what exactly she does next and whether she parlays this into some other kind of political committee or presidential run or what. But the bottom line is Congressman Cheney is not going anywhere.
As far as that's the headline of the recent story you wrote on this, as far as keeping her megaphone, let's talk about that for a little bit. She'll still stay on the January 6th committee for as long as she's in office. What do you think yesterday does as far as her role in the committee and the impact it has?
It doesn't look like it's going to change her role on the committee at all, actually. Like, She still has this very high profile perch that she'll use through her role as the vice chair of the committee. The committee has made it clear that they want to stay through the very end of this Congress. And the deadline they see actually, you know, is January. So, you know, they have more hearings teed up in September. They have another report coming. And this will continue to be a major platform for Cheney, for her to try to deny a path for the former president to return to power.
We saw, as far as the previous, I think one of the stories highlighted the fact that in her previous primary, she won by an astounding number as far as Republicans. That sea change happening within this primary, is it all strictly connected to her statements about President Trump, do you think?
It's a large part of it. I mean, you know, the former president, of course, did endorse her challenger, Harriet Hageman, and who emerged victorious last night. But at the same time, we saw House Republican leadership really take a stand against Cheney as well. Leader Kevin McCarthy, right, endorsed against Cheney. And so as a result, not only did we see a lot of the donor money start to go towards Cheney, we even saw some of the usual consulting firms and advertising firms that usually work with candidates move away from Cheney just because of this involvement of House Republican leadership, a very rare thing normally.
Well, your colleague Alex Eisenstadt in a similar story talked about how Mark Meadows eventually had a role in Harriet Hageman running in the support of Jim Jordan of Ohio in that role. A lot of people in the background working to this moment.
That's for sure. And I mean, you know, you can't help but notice, too, that a lot of these people who were working with Hageman were also people that were targets of investigation by the January 6th committee. And so this is where we kind of have the whole confluence of different ideologies and different parts of the party here.
We just showed folks at home the 10 Republicans that voted against in the impeachment, voting against President Trump, and only two standing right now. What does that do as far as the president's track record when it comes to endorsements and things along that line?
Well, for one, it shows that former President Trump, despite having somewhat of a mixed bag when it comes to the overall endorsement record, still has a very strong hand when it comes to these House primaries, you know, usually fairly low turnout affairs, where something like an endorsement from the former president could really gin up turnout. And for that matter, it shows how the Republican Party, in many ways, is still hung up on the result of the 2020 election, right? Well, what happened in many of these primaries was actually that it became a referendum over the 2020 election, whether the member there voted to certify or not. And so as a result, take Washington State, for example. Congresswoman Herrera Butler lost to Joe Kent, right? Someone who explicitly campaigned on making it a referendum on the 2020 election certification. And for that matter, a vote to impeach the former president. And so, as these members who voted to impeach Trump and members who voted to certify the 2020 election fade from public view, we could very well see this new wave of House Republicans coming in that do deny the results of the 2020 election and do, still very strongly support former President Trump.
You talked a little bit about this political or this committee that she's forming that we're supposedly going to get information in the next coming weeks. What could be the strength or, the, I guess, the strengths and liabilities if she decides to go further, even possibly making a run for 2024 herself?
Well, the main pathway here for her is less to actually gain the Republican presidential nomination. As we saw last night, Congresswoman Cheney's roughly third or so of the primary vote in Wyoming shows how it could be kind of a steep climb to become a general election Republican presidential candidate. However, at the very least, she could end up being a spoiler against Trump if he decides to run, or some sort of Trump adjacent person. Congresswoman Cheney has made it very clear that she doesn't want to see Trump in office again. And so while Cheney herself might not win the primary, she could be damaging enough for Trump that another candidate could emerge.
Politico congressional reporter Nicholas Wu joining C-SPAN on Wednesday morning's Washington Journal program. The only Republican U.S. senator who voted to impeach former President Trump and who is running for re-election, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, moving on to the general election, along with one of her Republican rivals who was endorsed by former President Trump, Kelly Shibaka. Tuesday's primary in Alaska was an open primary, everyone running on the same ballot, with the top four candidates advancing to the general election. Lisa Murkowski was tops, got 44%. Kelly Shibaka right behind at 40%. Kelly Shibaka was interviewed on Newsmax today saying she feels good about her position.
We knew we were going to be going to the general election. What we didn't know is what the spread would be. And I'm happy to say right now the race is neck and neck. That is huge for me, starting as a no-name candidate last year, and I've never done politics before, up against a 21-year incumbent from a 41-year Murkowski monarchy. The other big news to report is more than half of Alaska did not pick Lisa Murkowski as their first choice, and actually was a lot more than half, which means I think we just saw Senator Murkowski hit her ceiling. In fact, she didn't give out any comments last night. That is great news. We can actually see our path to victory really clearly from here. I think we're only going to have three more months of Lisa Murkowski. And that's because Alaskans know she talks to us and says one thing. She does something different in Washington, D.C. No one on either side of the aisle up here can actually trust her because she's an inconsistent vote. We've got a principled Democrat in the race. We have a consistent and reliable Alaskan who's common sense. That's me. Alaskans have a clear choice, and they started to show that yesterday.
Alaska Senate candidate Republican Kelly Shibaka, former commissioner of Alaska's Department of Administration, interviewed by the TV station Newsmax today. Following Tuesday's election primary, she'll be facing Senator Lisa Murkowski and two other finalists in that general election. Associated Press putting together these clips of Senator Murkowski speaking to reporters after she voted on Tuesday.
Hope that we do not become the party of one person. I hope that we do not become the party of Donald Trump. We need to be the party of those strong values that brought young women like me into a party several decades ago. My campaign is not about Donald Trump. My campaign is not Donald Trump's campaign. My campaign is an Alaska-based, Alaska Solutions campaign that we're running with, I'll just tell you, we are going to move forward in a way that demonstrates the integrity and the openness and the transparency that I think Alaskans want, deserve, and should be entitled to.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska. She has been in that seat since 2002. The other closely watched race in Alaska for U.S. Representative, this reporting from the Anchorage Press, Democratic candidate Mary Peltola left Election Day leading Alaska's special election for U.S. House, but the state's new ranked choice voting system may leave Republican candidate and former governor Sarah Palin the ultimate winner. Mary Peltola has 38% of the first choice vote. Sarah Palin has 33%, and Republican Nick Begich III has 29%. Many ballots left to be counted. Some can arrive as late as August 31st. And at that point, the third place finisher is going to be eliminated. Voters' second choices will be counted to determine a winner. And that will fill the Alaska's only U.S. House seat until January, finishing out the term of Congressman Don Young, who died earlier this year. Don Young was a Republican. And of course, that name Sarah Palin, she was also a vice presidential running mate to John McCain in 2008. Rudy Giuliani, former personal attorney to former President Donald Trump, testifying today in Atlanta, Georgia, before a grand jury looking at attempts to overturn Georgia's 2020 election. And Rudy Giuliani's lawyers informed this week that he is a target of the investigation, may be indicted. Rudy Giuliani sworn by reporters as he entered the Fulton County Courthouse.
Mr. Giuliani, when you met with Georgia lawmakers, did you lie to them?
We will not talk about this until it's over. It's a grand jury, and grand juries, as I recall, a secret.
Do you believe President Trump is the ultimate target of this investigation?
I'm not going to comment on the grand jury investigation.
What do you think their ultimate goal is here?
About it.
What are you expecting to talk about here today?
Well, they asked the questions, and we'll see.
Will you be cooperative? I mean, your attorney in New York says he can't promise how responsive you'll be.
Goodbye.
Questions to Rudy Giuliani, former personal attorney to former President Donald Trump, also former mayor of New York City, going to the courthouse Wednesday morning in Atlanta. Atlanta Journal-Constitution writing that Giuliani's appearance is undoubtedly one of the most high-profile for the 23-person grand jury, which was selected in May and has already interviewed dozens of witnesses. It's tasked with investigating whether Trump or his allies like Giuliani broke any state laws as they tried to overturn Georgia's 2020 presidential election results. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. An article at the Arizona Republic begins, "The federal government will impose deeper cuts on the drought-stricken Colorado River," officials said on Tuesday, reducing water deliveries to Arizona by one-fifth starting in January. The Bureau of Reclamation announced what it called urgent action as water levels in the river's two largest reservoirs continued to drop. We'll be talking to the reporter who wrote that story in just a moment, but first some reaction to the water allocation cuts from Carrie Lake, Republican nominee for Arizona governor. She spoke Tuesday on the Mike Broomhead Show on KTAR Radio in Arizona.
And we're going to be seeing big cuts to agriculture. That means cuts in our food supply chain that we just can't afford right now. So we need to have a comprehensive plan to address that problem. I think in the short term, we're going to have conservation and potentially leasing water from the tribes is an option. Midterm, we need to build out some of the wells and canals for groundwater and frankly invest in more storage capacity on the Salt and Verde. And then long term, you just mentioned it, we need to look at sustainable water, sustainable supply of fresh water, whether that be desal, there's issues with that. I'd rather work with within the United States. But we can look at piping water in from river basins around the country. That is not a pie-in-the-sky idea, but we have to get on it, and we have to get on it now. It's a priority, and we're going to look at all of that.
Deborah Utasia-Kroll is an Indigenous Affairs reporter with the Arizona Republic covering climate issues, reporting on this drought. Joining us now by phone, thank you so much. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation announcement this week, Arizona to lose 21% of its usual water from the Colorado River next year. What kind of impact would that have on the state?
Well, the thing you have to remember is that these are not unanticipated cuts. A few years ago, the seven basin states, the 30 tribes that have water rights in the basin, and the federal government negotiated a drought contingency plan. And we are simply entering into the second round of already agreed upon cuts. So Arizona is losing 21% of its Colorado River allocation. Nevada is losing 25,000 acre feet, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the percentage. And Mexico is losing about 100,000 acre feet. So in Arizona, that amounts to 592,000 acre feet of its allocation.
California not losing any water under this.
Yeah, and this is because there's several reasons. Going all the way back to 1922 with the Colorado River Compact, California started drawing from the Colorado River early on. They negotiated a compact where everybody agreed about how much everybody was going to get from the seven basin states. In the early 1970s, when the state of Arizona wanted to build a canal to access its share of Colorado River water, there was another negotiated settlement, and Arizona agreed to be junior rights holder. That means that they're the junior rights holder, they get the first round of cuts. California's cuts will not come unless and until a further what they call a drought tier is reached.
You said that this is the second phase of an agreed upon framework. Does that mean that Arizona and the other states are ready for this and it won't have a big impact?
They've already fallowed a lot of fields in central Arizona. The farmers, particularly in Pinal County, were told when we entered the first tier of cuts that their Colorado River water was going to be cut. A lot of them have turned to groundwater instead. Others have let their fields go fallow or have sold out. Some of them have sold to solar companies. So it's not like people didn't know this was coming. I think the surprise is that a lot of people didn't realize it was going to be so fast. The drought between the two problems of another long-term drought in the Southwest, exacerbated by climate change, the river has been shrinking faster than what people thought it was going to.
There was some reports that the seven states were due to come up with another agreement for cuts, but missed the deadline, and that's why the federal government acted. Can you elaborate more on that?
The federal government had given the seven basin states, and don't forget there's 30 tribes involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
They had given everybody a deadline of August 16th, which was yesterday. And we all knew that the Bureau of Reclamation and Department of Interior, of which it's an agency, was due to issue its 2023 allocations sometime pretty soon. So I have a feeling they chose that date because of the fact that the deadline had been missed.
We're talking with Deborah Utasia-Kroll from the Arizona Republic. Aside from addressing climate change, are there any other proposals on the table now to reduce water use going into the future?
There's been some movement. You saw what's going on in southern Nevada. The state of Nevada passed a bill that bans the use of Colorado River water and any non-functional lawns going forward. So that's going to impact a lot of water use. Also, Las Vegas and southern Nevada have been working to conserve water, to reduce water use for quite a while. The Colorado River Valley tribes, those are the tribes whose land bases are south of Boulder Dam all the way down to Mexico, have really taken the lead in water conservation by fallowing fields, by restoring some of their riverine systems, which actually helps preserve water over the long run. At least two of them have purchased technology from Israel to reduce their agricultural water use because they're both agricultural tribes. And they're doing other measures to, fallowing fields. One of them, the Colorado River Indian Tribes, has actually saved about 10% of its mandated Colorado River allocation. So here in Arizona, we see a lot of voluntary programs. Like the city of Phoenix just issued a stage one drought alert, which means that they're going to be asking residents to reduce their water use, to be more mindful of how they use water, shorter showers, removing lawns and putting in xeriscape, that sort of thing. Statewide, a couple of years ago, there was a push by some legislators to enact a groundwater management protocol for rural areas, because when Colorado River gets shut off, those farmers are turning to groundwater, and the groundwater is being depleted faster than it's being replenished by rain and other means. And once those porous aquifers collapse in on themselves because the water is not holding them apart any longer, they're going to collapse, and that storage will be gone for basically forever. So there was some movement to better manage the groundwater. Those measures have fallen short. So we're not sure what's going to happen next other than more cuts to farmers.
Deborah Utasia-Kroll, Indigenous Affairs reporter covering climate, culture, and commerce with the Arizona Republic. She's on Twitter, @DebKroll. and find her stories at azcentral.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
On Wall Street today, the Dow down 171, NASDAQ down 164, S&P down 31. Commerce Department reporting sales at U.S. retailers remaining flat in July after rising 0.8% in June. Associated Press says this comes as persistently high inflation and rising interest rates force many Americans to spend more cautiously. State Department says there is still no official U.S. response to the written response by Iran to the European negotiated text to try to bring the U.S. back into the 2015 nuclear agreement. Wall Street Journal writing that Iran is raising several issues Iran wanted incorporated into the agreement. The EU has said its draft was the final text of a possible deal when it sent it out, announcing that negotiations were over. The Wall Street Journal article continues, central to Iran's demands, the Iranian negotiating team has said, are assurances that Western companies investing in Iran will be protected if the U.S. withdrew from the pact again, as it did under former President Donald Trump. Some questions today at the State Department briefing to spokesperson Ned Price.
Have you guys responded yet to the EU after reviewing Iran's responses to their proposition?
So I don't have much to offer you beyond what we said yesterday. As I noted at the time, we had received Iran's comments via the EU. We are studying them. That was the case yesterday. That continues to be the case today. We are engaged in consultations with the EU as well as with our European allies on the way ahead. And you've heard us say again and again, especially in recent days, we ultimately agree with the bottom line proposition of High Representative Borrell. The reason he put forward this proposal in the first place was out of recognition that what could be negotiated has been negotiated. The High Representative and the way in which he has handled this process has certainly narrowed the scope of that conversation. It has crystallized the decision for Iran. We have been sincere. We have been steadfast in our commitment to seeking a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA. And we're grateful for Mr. Borrell and the efforts he's undertaken to seek to get us there.
And do you have any time frame for when you'll be providing a response to the EU?
I don't, not one that I can provide publicly at least, but again, we have been in communication with the EU. We've been in communication with other European allies on the way ahead.
And just one more question. Can you elaborate a little bit more as to why the Biden administration is confident that the U.S. would be able to uphold the commitments that are in the current deal as it stands now, given that it hinges on actions taken by Congress and this building lifting some Iranians from the SDN list and the like? Like, are you confident that those actions would be taken if you guys got back into the deal?
Kylie, we look at this through the lens not of politics, but of national security. And we are confident that a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA remains the best and really the most effective means by which to once again verifiably and permanently constrain Iran's nuclear program. The fact is that in the years in which we have not had a JCPOA, since May of 2018, Iran's nuclear program has galloped forward in a way that is deeply concerning and alarming, given where we were when the JCPOA was in full effect in terms of Iran's breakout time, to where we are now with a breakout time that can be measured not in a year, not in months, but in weeks or potentially even less.
That was State Department spokesman Ned Price. A closer look now at the negotiations over reviving the Iran nuclear deal. We're joined by Peter Brooks, senior research fellow with the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for being with us. European Union officials sending the U.S. and Iran this final text. Iran says it's responded in writing, but none of the details have been made public. What's your thoughts on where things stand at this point?
That's a tough one, right? Because we don't know that much. I'm concerned. I didn't like the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action for a lot of reasons, and I'm happy to go into those. And I worry that we're looking at just another, you know, a redo of that. I thought that was a, you know, a failed negotiation and a failed treaty because of things like sunset provisions, and it didn't address the missile program. There were issues with verifications. For instance, Iranian military bases couldn't be inspected. You know, centrifuge research continued. I mean, I saw it more as the original 2015 agreement as a speed bump rather than a stop sign for Iran's nuclear program. So the idea that they may be going, they're going back to something similar to that makes me pretty nervous. And I have a lot of concerns, but I haven't seen the text. The administration's been very quiet about it and said a lot because I think they're at this crucial point, they believe, in the negotiation. So I think we're kind of, you know, we're a little ahead of ourselves here in talking about it. And we look forward to hearing what, you know, what came of it and where we go from there.
There's a story at CNN saying that a regional diplomat told them on Tuesday that Tehran is seeking guarantees that it will be compensated if a future U.S. president pulls out of the pact.
Yep.
What's your reaction to that?
Don't like it. You know, and I don't think this administration can guarantee that, right? If you have a change in administrations or even another Democratic administration, they might decide this is a bad idea or Iran is violating it once again. And so Iran's going to try to get whatever they can. Remember, they tried to get the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps removed from the Foreign Terrorism Organization lists and other things like that. And they're going to push as hard as they can to get what they can in these negotiations. But I don't think that the administration can, you know, can agree to that. The other thing is that just because the United States left the agreement under the Trump administration didn't mean that the agreement couldn't go on. Iran decided to go ahead and violate the tenets of the agreement, but there was a number of other partners, as we know. I mean, you know, there's France and Britain and China and Russia and Germany/the EU that they could have continued this. They could have continued this agreement, but they decided not to. So, yeah, the administration, I don't think any administration can guarantee that in our democratic system, that a future administration will adhere to a treaty. Like, think about the Russians and the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which they were violating. And the Trump administration decided, in my view, correctly to leave.
If the Biden administration is intent on trying to get the U.S. back into this deal, and assuming it's the strongest deal that can be negotiated at this point, then what would be your view on what the administration should be doing if not going back into this deal to try to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
Well, there's a lot of things that we should be doing regardless. I mean, myself and my colleague Jim Phillips have been calling for a plan B for a long time because these negotiations haven't seemed to have gone anywhere. You know, the administration promised us this was going to be priority. They promised us, you know, quote unquote, longer and stronger. And my concern is going to be shorter and weaker. I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of things we need to know. You know, what are Iran's enrichment capabilities going to be going forward? What's going to happen to the uranium stockpile that they've put together? I mean, some folks have said that Iran is basically able to put together a nuclear weapon today. Now, maybe not a bomb, but they have enough fissile material, Michael, to put together a bomb. And maybe have more in the near future in terms of fissile materials. What about verification and compliance? I mean, it drove me crazy, the idea that Iran, you know, could say that our military bases are an IRGC bases are off limits to inspectors. I mean, how can you have that? I mean, the IRGC is part of this program and leads the program as a nuclear program, as a matter of fact. How can you say that, well, you can see here, but you can't see there? You know, we need challenge inspections where we say, hey, we have suspicions about something here. We want to go see this. And you have to open up the gates and let us look at the IAEA inspectors, the international inspectors, look around. I mean, that's critical to any sort of arms control or agreement. I also worry about, you know, centrifuge research. Iran has, over time, has been able to do this. They've improved the efficiency and effectiveness of their centrifuges, which is critical in the enrichment of uranium, which is the fissile material that's used in a nuclear weapon. Besides, another option, obviously, is plutonium, but they don't have a plutonium program to our knowledge. So, I mean, we're going to have to see. But I have, you know, a serious concerns. I think Congress is going to have views too. This is something that a lot of people aren't talking about, but what are the congressional views going to be on any sort of agreement that comes out? Right now, it's an executive agreement, but Congress, because of concerns about what Iran's done and its international behavior, I mean, look at the things we've seen recently, you know, targeting U.S. officials, you know, the Salman Rushdie attack, you know, there's been attacks on U.S. troops in Syria at the Al-Tanf base, They're supporting Russia with drones in its war in Ukraine. I mean, it's the foremost state sponsor of terrorism. It's involved in Syria and Yemen, Persian Gulf attacks, the repression of its own people, its cyber activities. I mean, Iran is a bad actor. And, you know, the idea that Iran, you know, the foremost sponsor of terrorism would have the world's most terrifying weapon is of great concern. So there's a lot of things we need to be doing. I think we need to, you know, ramp up U.S. sanctions on Iran. We need to work with our U.S. allies to do the same. We need to develop a favorable military posture in the Persian Gulf, along with partners and allies, to balance Iran. We need to strengthen the regional security of allies and partners out there. We need to bolster Israel's ability to deter Iran. And I think it would be good if we could facilitate or help Arab-Israeli relations, as we've seen under like the Abraham Accords.
And finally, we said at the beginning, we don't have a lot of details about this, but what's your gut feeling? Do you think that this will succeed and that the U.S. will rejoin the nuclear pact?
I'm afraid that we're putting a Band-Aid on a very bad wound. That's my concern.
Not that it would work, but do you actually think it's going to go through, that the Biden administration rejoin?
I think the administration will attempt to rejoin this pact in some form. Like I said, we need to know what that is. But yes, I think they will for a lot of reasons.
Peter Brooks, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Follow him on Twitter at Brooks_Peter and his work at heritage.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
And an update today on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. CNN reports that Ukraine's defense intelligence has hinted the start of a long-awaited and touted counteroffensive to retake territory lost to Russia could be starting soon, its spokesperson said in a televised address on Wednesday. Andriy Yusov said, in the near future, there will be very acute events on the entire front. This is not about binding to any dates. However, we have to consider the factor of the Independence Day of Ukraine. He was referencing the country's Independence Day on August 24th. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more stories that Washington is talking about sent right to you every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.